For some reason, whenever I join a Skype call, my sound always mutes, and my sound window open, ready to unmute it. And when I close that, it worked. So, something's just really...
That's really interesting. I hope we capture that for the podcast, that comment you shared.
Hello, and welcome. This is the PC Gamer Podcast, episode number 179 for Thursday, June 11th. Today on the podcast, Gary Steinman and myself are back from E3 and excited to be back. And we're going to be reflecting on all the good and great games we saw. I'm your host, Evan Lotti, PC Gamer Associate Editor, and joining me today are the following podcast superstars. As always, producer Andy Bauman.
Hey guys, good to have you guys back from E3. Missed you out last week.
Thank you very much. And likewise, PC Gamer Super Intern number 2, Max McGee.
Howdy doody.
And PC Gamer EIC, Gary Steinman.
These headphones are making my hair messy.
We wouldn't want that. All right, guys, so we have a ton of stuff to reflect on, and Gary and I saw somewhere between, 15 or so games at E3 last week, and we'd love to cover them all, because they're all worth talking about. So I don't know if we have a consensus on game of the show, Gary, but we were both very impressed by Old Republic from LucasArts and BioWare.
It was kind of, it was an interesting coincidence that our very first appointment was LucasArts. And we saw Monkey Island first, which we'll return to in a bit, but then we saw Tor, and then we got to play Tor. And both of us came in with little to no expectations. I'm not a big Star Wars fanboy. You had your own thoughts about it going in. And we came away completely blown away. We were both saying to each other that this game basically spoils all MMOs for us from now on. Assuming that it delivers, and from what little I played, it seems like it's on track to deliver. It's basically a fully featured BioWare role-playing game that just happens to be an MMO. I recall one of the things the guy said to us when he said, there's no repeated quests, so whatever you do, whoever you play, you're not going to see the same kind of early quests or early missions early on. If you play it for 5 hours a week, you could play this game for the rest of your life and never see the same thing again. I believe that they might be able to deliver on that.
Like yourself, I'm not really a Star Wars fan. I'm not a Star Trek guy. When we saw the trailer, it was really exciting, but it was sort of like, okay, that's visually interesting, but like, I want to see gameplay. I want to see it played and see it in motion. And when we did, I mean, I keep saying to people that whatever engine they've developed, I mean, it resembles an action game. The detail of the scripting, the way in which combat takes place doesn't resemble this battle dance that the characters are doing, standing in one spot. The effects, the detail of the textures in the backgrounds, and again, like being fully voiced. It's not just a game in which you have to read. There's just blocks of text to search for what bit mentions the quest and what item you have to go grab. It generally felt like BioWare is applying its the techniques it's most familiar with, dramatic game storytelling. And like you said, it just happens to be an MMO. They showed us three classes. They showed us a smaller class, which, as I was saying to Josh earlier this week, it basically has a dedicated game mechanic to it. The smuggler class, again, is sort of like the Han Solo class on the Rebel side. And if I'm correct, he's the only character that can use cover and can blind fire through cover.
That's how they set it up. They were struggling. Mm-hmm. They said, with how do you take a class that can't be as strong in combat, but it's based around the notion of being kind of sneaky and smugglery, and they did. They built a cover combat system that you'd expect from a third person action game. I mean, we didn't get our hands on that, but it looked fairly robust and as solid as you'd get in a third person action RPG. Maybe even just a full action game, and they built that into the game. Evan, you had, while I was actually playing it, you asked them a great question about that binary good evil decision and how they're gonna address that. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, of course. So something like a complaint I've had for most BioWare games is, even though I'm a fan of Morality Systems and in KOTOR and Mass Effect, in Jade Empire, I didn't play that too much, but whatever the spectrum of your decisions were and saving alien races, and it always kind of came down to this, you know, at the end of the game, you either get the good ending or the evil ending. It's sort of black and white in that sense, and there's no, I mean, you can exist in the middle ground, but you're still going to sort of fall in one of those two categories. So because there's two factions in the game, you know, like the Horde and the Alliance and other MMOs and whatnot, I sort of asked them, well, okay, can you be a good Sith? Like, how do you make the Sith sort of approachable and still, you know, not so dark and brooding that they're automatically evil? I wish I could dig up the exact quote, but essentially he was saying, like, you know, these are kind of just imperial people. They don't necessarily have completely dark, evil ideals. It can totally exist at that good level of the spectrum, and you'll have a completely different experience than a Sith player that chooses to take a darker role. So, I mean, that's one of the most reassuring things to me, that they don't try to artificially set the two sides at odds that way, I guess. They sort of described, like, the spectrum of morality as, okay, maybe a bounty hunter will exist with between X and Y, but maybe a dark Jedi will exist between Y and Z. Like, they can have more potential to sort of be more evil because of, they might have a few more quests available to them. Something inherent about that class, and that makes sense, I think.
It also affects, there's lots of branching in the major events based on your actions. So if you're one of the, in the demo that they showed us, you're a Sith Lord and you board a ship to try to correct the actions of a captain that's disobeying orders. And you could choose to either, you know, try to get this captain in line, win him over, or you could just execute him because he disobeyed an order. And I'm not exactly sure how that will play into your character development, but it changed how the rest of the mission played out. If you won the captain over, his troops will support you, and different troops board the ship. If you kill him, different things happen. So they have that pretty well thought out, at least within each individual instance. They seem to have a range of things that can happen depending on your actions, and hopefully that will reverberate throughout the game and kind of send ripples throughout the game.
Yeah, they actually referred to that specific event as a flashpoint, sort of like a big decision, and it was exciting because you were sort of isolated on the ship, right? You weren't just in a cave that you could walk out of any time. Like, you were in this moment. You couldn't just hit escape and get out of it. You had to take care of it and resolve it. And I forgot to mention this, but we were playing with another player, and during our dialogue sections with, we were talking to that captain, deciding whether we should execute him or spare him or take a different approach. We basically had multiplayer dialogue where our player-controlled ally was also contributing to the same conversation with his dialogue bits. I don't know how much they're going to implement that to the rest of the story. It seemed like it'd be a lot of work, but I mean, that was just a very cool detail, I think.
At least to this point, it shows a ton of promise. It really, I think, was our personal games of the show. Mm-hmm. I mean, there might have been bigger games. Well, I don't know bigger, but there might have been games that were further along that might win Game of the Show awards, but for you and me, coming out of that, we were both like, this is our game. This is our Game of the Show. This is a game we want to play the most.
Absolutely. Yeah. I want it to come out as soon as possible, honestly. I mean, there's a lot of action MMOs coming out later this year.
But definitely look to our September issue. We're going to have a lot more on this game.
Yep. September issue out in July.
Yeah.
Can I stick with the E3 BioWare theme for a second? And, want to touch on Mass Effect 2, and I know, Evan, you have a lot sort of preview knowledge and stuff of Dragon Age Origins, and you seemed pretty, like, stoked about it. But there seemed to be, like, a level of disappointment surrounding the game's E3 presence, mainly because of the, like, sex trailer they showed everybody.
Yeah.
And the Rock trailer, and you know, like, as much as I am down for, like, I loved The Witcher, I loved the themes in that, like, dealing with the sexual relationships, but, like, I don't know, everybody sort of seemed to think that it was like a 14-year-old's version of that in Dragon Age, and, like, it's obviously a huge game and it's hard to tell from just a little bit, but, like, what are your guys' impressions of that game?
I'm really glad you asked that question. So yeah, basically the demo for Dragon Age was a little underwhelming. They came in and the first thing they showed us was, okay, this is how you have sex with a character, you know, a main female character. And basically they showed that this gift system where there's certain items that certain characters have an affinity for, if you are able to give it to them or track it down through a quest, and you know, you'll build your relationship with them that way. After that, they showed a really awesome boss battle with like some unique animations. It was this giant dragon. It was the first time, you know, thank goodness there's actual dragons in Dragon Age. But, you know, getting back to the root of your question, I think there's been a fundamental change in how EA is marketing that game. Ever since that the new trailer came out, I believe it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And if you haven't seen it, it's a really exciting trailer, but it's backed by a Marilyn Manson song. It's sort of like this, you know, there is a certain demographic, I think, of people that listen to heavy metal and, you know, like fantasy and like, you know, that kind of aesthetic. But
yeah, but I mean, I don't think Marilyn Manson actually fits into that, to be honest.
It really doesn't, especially when the song is called "This Is the New Shit" or whatever. It's distasteful for me because, I mean, before, you know, when we went to see the game in December, they were really promoting it as like, this is, I mean, you guys all probably remember, like, they're promoting it, this is the spiritual successor for Baldur's Gate, and this is a story-driven game, there's lots of quests and branching characters and 6 origin stories, and that's not what they're focusing on anymore, it seems like. It seems like either they weren't getting the response that they wanted, or they want to distinguish themselves from a different, from their competition in a certain way.
I think what's going on there is that someone in EA marketing got a little scared, because ultimately this is a very hardcore game. It is not necessarily a very accessible game. There's elements of the combat that will be almost impenetrable for a lot of the console crowd and for a lot of new school PC gamers. It's not a casual game. It's a pretty hardcore game, and it's a pretty deep and exciting and awesome game for it, or at least what we've seen so far. So I guess my message to people would be, you know, don't get put off by the fact that they somehow feel the need to market it so it reaches a broader audience. There was a little bit of wink wink with that "This Is How You Sleep with Somebody" demo, and it's easy to miss that wink wink. They knew that they had to do this. They knew that they were kind of pandering a little bit. But you know, the essence of the game, the choice system, the combat, if you want a super deep combat system, if you're looking for that spiritual successor to Baldur's Gate, it's still there. You know, they want this to be, if they want this to be the next Mass Effect, you know, marketing it for what it is, a hardcore throwback, might not work, especially since they have ambitions to get this out on the console.
I'd agree. I mean, you sort of look at it as, you know, after the delay, it was supposed to come out in March. Now it's coming out October 20th. This sort of, you know, it's kind of the same mistake EA made last year, honestly. Like, I want to be critical of them about this, but Dead Space and Mirror's Edge, I mean, 2 completely original IPs, great games in their own right, you know, and they sort of get lost in that big crowd between Fallout 3 and Call of Duty 5. So again, I mean, I guess they have to take a new approach and get some attention however way they can. But again, like Gary's saying, like that experience, that hardcore experience is certainly very much intact from what we've seen.
Okay, so it's not like they're drastically changing the, like how they were talking about. They have their own system of like really deep RPG gameplay. They're not mucking with that.
I don't think so. I think that's purely a different marketing message. And I think you could look to the fact that they want this to be huge. But, you know, someone realized that there are a lot of the, you know, the bullet points behind this game basically speak to a more hardcore, more focused, more PC-centric audience, which is great for us. But if they want this to really pop on consoles, they, and I don't want to pull this notion that PC is more mature, consoles more, you know.
No, it's okay. We can do that. No, you know.
but there is an element of that. They're trying to reach that broader base for something that, and it shouldn't put you off if you're in that broader base, but it isn't necessarily designed for that. It is designed to the core PC gamer, and it is designed for somebody looking for an old school experience modernized, spiffed up, and enhanced to a great extent.
So do you think that if you guys get another look at it before it comes out, they'll be like, oh, it's PC Gamer. Like, they'll give you the real look rather than the sort of marketing push.
I mean, this was E3. They were not just showing it to us in the press, but they were showing it to every single retailer that matters.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they were trying to deliver a message. So I guess it's up to us to figure that out. We will, I'm sure, see it again before review, and we will, I'm sure, do some sort of bigger hands-on coverage again before review. And I guess that'll be our challenge. Keep us honest here, Andy. Make sure that we tell you the truth about it. But that's what we'll look into. Is it really the game they promised earlier, or are they moving in a different direction? I don't see them changing direction completely. It really is a different marketing message, but not a different game.
Absolutely.
That's good to hear.
And great question again. Thanks for asking that.
Yeah, and just real quick, as Evan said, they did show a battle at the end, and the battle looked phenomenal. It had a dragon in it. It had, you know, some really complex combat and great effects going on. You know, the essence of the battle system, the essence of the dialogue choice system is still there.
Awesome. And, I mean, the general consensus about Mass Effect 2 is it just looks beautiful as well.
Yeah. And I went into this demo sort of really skeptical about, like, I've been sort of unhappy with their marketing of this idea that Shepard dies in Mass Effect 2, and that's, you know, raising that question, that was sort of the first push that their marketing made. And, I mean, it was kind of preposterous. Like, any fan of the game would not believe that that's a possibility, because they know you have to transfer your character from one game to another. But that being said, like, they showed an incredible demo. Like, there's subtle engine improvements and to the lighting and the textures and the combat. You know, like, bazooka-like weapons and more interesting characters in your party. And it feels like the game the first one should have been. I don't know, what did you come away with on that, Gary?
Wait, but the first one was awesome.
It was awesome, but they made a lot of compromises in, for example, like the exploration. The outposts you visit are identical, carbon copies.
The only really, like, really fleshed out stuff was the main mission.
The party control systems were sort of sketchy. I mean, it wasn't really plausible combat, but you had to assign commands. I wasn't a big fan of the combat mostly, but, I mean, the presentation that they gave was outstanding. One of the best demos I've ever seen.
Yeah, it made the game really exciting. It really reinforced the notion of choice and how it will affect things. So if you played the first game, your choices really carry through into the second game. And their point wasn't that Shepard will die, but their point was that Shepard can die. So your choices really do matter. And if you're not careful, you'll lose Shepard. The game will go on. It'll still be exciting. You'll still want to play it. But, you know, there are real consequences to what you do and how you do it. And they said that, made it believable, and got us excited. Like Evan said, he was turned off maybe a little bit by the notion that Shepard might die. But now you're excited about the notion that what you do could keep Shepard alive. It kind of like turned that on its ear. It's like, it's not that Shepard can die, but you could keep him alive. You better work hard at doing it.
Exactly. And I like the notion that they gave. I mean, they didn't say it directly, but there was sort of an idea of Shepard is sort of a mercenary character now. He's pulling together a party of the most dangerous people in the galaxy to confront some big threat. And I think that's an exciting shift, you know, in that things, the stakes are sort of higher now in Mass Effect 2, as they should be. So that was exciting. But, I mean, the whole thing looked wonderfully Blade Runner-like. There was a sequence in the beginning where they're in this sort of flying car vehicle, Shepard and another character, and they sort of merge with all these hundreds of flying vehicles in this giant city, this giant neon city, essentially. And
yeah, extremely Blade Runner-esque, including that kind of sunset lighting into some high-rise, you know, climbing up into the sky. It was really gorgeous, very cinematic.
Yeah, just that feeling of constant night. Absolutely. So I guess that wraps up the BioWare portion of
the game. Yeah, it's a big chunk of
it. Was, but, I mean, everything they showed was exciting indeed. So Gary and I we had to split up for a couple portions of E3. Speaking for myself, my biggest surprise was out of Chaos Studios, published by THQ, a game called Homefront. It didn't get a ton of buzz up front. They did announce it at E3. It's written by the same guy that wrote Apocalypse Now and Red Dawn, if you've seen that movie. And the concept is very similar to Red Dawn in that this Korean force, near future, this Korean force has invaded the United States. They've occupied it, and you're 2 years in the occupation. Trying to fight back. I mean, one of the more exciting aspects of it is they have this this system called the drama engine, where events in the environment, combat, explosions, enemy AI are sort of meant to orbit around the player. In a matter of speaking, like if an explosion happens, it'll sort of be directed toward the player physically, and it's sort of meant to put attention on the player. And then that's always an important part of making a cinematic game. There will be up to 32 person multiplayer. They didn't really give any details on that. And it's still a far way off. I mean, it's definitely a 2010 title.
Maybe early 2011.
Yeah, very much so. But I actually found it very Half-Life like, and I want to say that I reserve that kind of impression for a lot of games. But I like the way in which, I mean, the demo started out and you get the idea that you're sort of a leadership figure within the resistance, and you wake up in this house that you find kind of in middle America, like a duplex house, and these characters are talking to you, and you know it's sort of this very, you know, war-ridden situation, and you're under occupation, but it's not, I mean, the aesthetic is not like a post-apocalyptic thing where everything's gray and brown and there's debris everywhere. It's there's plants, and there's, you know, baseball diamonds, and there's people walking their kids around. I mean, you're not entering a game and suddenly being confronted by a sergeant, essentially, and telling, like, giving orders, if that's a good distinction. And that really gave a positive impression to me, because it felt more realistic in that sense. You're seeing normal people and how they would respond to this resistance. And, of course, you know, you get attacked by this Korean force, and they unload an APC, and they have better weapons than you. So it gave a great impression. We're definitely looking forward to seeing it more in the future, and seeing what they're about.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that from what you said, and then from what I've heard following up on that. The game that I saw that you didn't see that I'm very excited about is Brink from Bethesda and Splash Damage. It's a near future kind of sci-fi shooter with, I mean, what we saw was incredibly gorgeous. Of course, it was a controlled hands-off demo. But it was incredibly gorgeous, not just because of what they were showing on the screens, the polygon count, whatever, the technical underpinnings of the game, but because of the art style. I love the art style. It's it eschews that kind of next-gen brown in favor of a kind of post-apocalyptic world that still has pops of color, characters that split the difference between cartoony and realistic. It's got some neat ideas on how it dynamically generates missions and objectives throughout the game based on what you and your squad mates do, be it AI squad mates or human squad mates. For example, if a mission calls for an engineer and all of you happen to be soldier classes, it'll generate a submission to find a checkpoint where you could turn into an engineer. And if you choose that one, then all of your squad mates will end up having submissions generated where they will either protect you or escort you or support you in various ways. So it's constantly changing and evolving based on what you and your teammates do, what your friends do, what your enemies do. And the other neat thing that they talked about was how they want it to be seamless between solo, co-op, and, you know, competitive multiplayer, that you could drop into and out of the different modes, and you'll get the same kinds of experiences. So it's not like these are multiplayer maps, these are single player maps. The game itself is equally as playable in all formats. Whether they pull off everything that they intend to do, it's a long way off, and it's really our first showing of it, but it's definitely on my radar, and it's something that I'm really looking forward to.
But it's great to see Splash Damage working on that rather than another Quake Wars game. I wasn't really a big fan of Enemy Territory, but yeah.
Well, they're also doing Rogue Warrior.
That's right. which we weren't really too sold on, but we got to see Mickey Rourke in person, so.
We got to see, and who's the guy they base it on? The guy who kills people in 800 different ways?
I'm not sure. Some ex-Navy SEAL.
Yeah, but he was standing behind us during our demo, so we had to keep our eyes firmly on the screen and nod approvingly the whole time. And this is not a knock on the game. I won't editorialize on the game because, again, I don't want him to kill me. But even this, you know, even if I was tired from E3 and just wanted to drift off for a second, I kept focused because this guy can kill us in 800 different ways, as they reminded us before, during, and after the demo. So yeah. We were a little shaken, but we stuck around and watched the whole thing.
That was kind of a funny situation where we were watching his, you know, in-game representation of the guy over our shoulder killing people.
Yeah.
And, you know, how are you supposed to object in that situation, right?
It's exactly.
Pretty funny.
Awesome game, sir.
See, now you're setting up a bad system for future E3 demos because other developers are going to hear this, and they're all going to have hired killers at their demos.
And all those games are awesome.
Excellent. All right, so touching on Sega's games, we saw AVP and we saw Alpha Protocol. I think we had good impressions of both of those, Gary.
AVP was interesting because in a pre-E3 showing a few weeks before E3, they showed us the Predator gameplay. And to be honest, I wasn't impressed at all. It seemed kind of unbalanced. It seemed, I don't know, it just seemed unimpressive. And it's hard for me to actually put my hand firmly on why it was unimpressive, but it seemed unimpressive. Then they showed us the Marines. And it seemed what an Alien versus Predator game should be, or an Alien-related game should be. It had moody lighting. It ratcheted up the tension by providing, you know, this kind of eerie, spooky feeling that this, you know, this one alien skidding around that you might see, you might not see, is just stalking you. You felt constantly like someone was about to jump out at you. I turn around my impressions based on what I earlier. I wasn't that impressed, but now I see a lot of potential there. I'm not saying that I'm fully sold yet, but I see a ton of potential if they could continue to give us the kind of stuff that they showed us at E3.
The lighting tech in that game is some of the best I've ever seen, and that's exciting because it fits the gameplay style. I mean, you're carrying around these flares, for example, that you can use to sort of deploy in areas and light them a little better. And you also have a flashlight. And when you're fighting these very agile, sort of asymmetrical, unpredictable enemies in the xenomorphs. Looked promising to me indeed. And Alpha Protocol, I know, is a little later in the game, closer to releasing. And it was the first time I'd seen it.
I'd seen it before, and I liked it before. I like that it doesn't take itself so seriously.
Right.
It's kind of got this. What did they show us? A mission on a boat where you. I don't know. Maybe you could describe it.
I certainly can. So you're sort of. I'm not sure. I'm not even sure what the objective was. That's how serious it is. But you're on this sort of yacht for whatever reason, in a dock, and you're creeping around, probably trying to get to a computer panel or something. And there's, for whatever reason, there's strippers sort of scattered about this boat, and I mean, we sort of stumbled into this room where there's this guard with like an AK hanging out with the stripper, talking to her, and we're like, all right, well, let's just toss a grenade in there, I guess. And, you know, we killed them both. And it's just those kinds of like fun, those kinds of emergent funny moments, I guess. And it comes out in the dialogue, too. It's kind of playful. You're this debonair spy. You're cracking jokes with your enemies that are about to kill you and whatnot. And, you know, I just like the idea of existing, you know, in an RPG that has lots of choices in that sort of gray area constantly. You're not trying to be good or evil. You're a spy or manipulating people. You're bending the rules.
Actually, it's funny. They corrected us or people that were also in our demo with us. You're not a spy. They wanted us. What did they call you?
You're an operative or an agent?
Operative, yeah. So it's not about sneaking and skulking around, although there are elements of the game where you could develop your character to sneak and skulk around a little bit more. But it's more about being a deep cover operative or a behind enemy lines operative. And getting to what you said, it's not – the choice system isn't based on morality. It's based on just choices. Do you kill an arms dealer? Do you arrest an arms dealer? Do you rob an arms dealer? None of them are necessarily moral choices. They're just choices that will ripple through the game. You know, if you kill him, you might get some immediate benefit. If you Or if you kill him, maybe your handlers will be happy if you arrest him. I don't know what something else might happen. If you save him, you might get better deals on weapons from this guy down the line. So it's more about having your choices ripple through the game than having your choices turn you into good or evil.
It gave me that impression too. It felt a lot like Mass Effect in the same sense of almost in pacing, in that you're spending a certain amount of time in combat, and the combat's in third person. You're spending more time, you know, an equal amount of time talking to contacts, grabbing missions. But it felt a little more accessible in that I'm not, you know, walking from place to place. I know you sort of have a hub area that you talk to your handler throughout the game.
And it's kind of light, fun, third person action. They've said in the past how, you know, they're, you know, you have these goofy weapons power ups that that might not makes sense if you think of it in a serious sense, but if you think of it instead like, oh, I could trigger this skill that lets me spray unlimited bullets. If you think of it as magic, like their equivalent, the RPG equivalent of magic, it's like then all of a sudden it makes more sense, and then you realize that, okay, I've leveled up this skill, so I now could spend 7 seconds spraying unlimited bullets, so I could walk into a room and just spray my machine gun. Well, it's no different from being in a fantasy RPG and pulling off some super move. And that's kind of the attitude they have with this game, that they're not giving you, in that sense, it's the opposite in some ways of Mass Effect. They're not giving you a very serious game. They're giving you a lighthearted, fun, goofy game that has some serious themes and has some serious settings, but they're not taking themselves too serious throughout the process.
Absolutely. So I'm sure everyone wants to hear about Modern Warfare 2 as well, which we also got to play. So they essentially showed us the same demo that has been circulating around, that there's screenshots already out there for. You're with Captain McTavish, and it's in the future a little bit. Again, McTavish was the character you played in the first Modern Warfare, so he's sort of taking Captain Price's role seemingly in the second game. And they showed off the snowmobile driving and shooting while driving the snowmobile. They showed an infiltration mission where we had to rig some explosives and escape. And they showed this interesting, you know, as an introduction to that, there's this first person ice climbing sort of as a way of setting the tension and just building, you know, this introduction to a new space, I guess. So, I mean, it looked good, but in the same way, it was sort of more of what we expected. I mean, Infinity Ward sort of delivers those experiences that are, they are very much on rails, but at the same time, they're a roller coaster of, you know, very precise action, and you never feel like you're really sitting behind a box waiting for an enemy's head to pop up so you can shoot it. You feel like you're being pushed through this world a little bit better than the first game. So, I mean, it looked good. It didn't really surprise us, but I mean, we have high expectations for it, I guess.
Yeah, no surprises, but plenty of excitement. The demo was really exciting. We were on the edges of our seat. I think you had mentioned to me after the demo how you kept writing down in your notes, this could be an action movie, this could be an action movie sequence, or something like that. And it was breathtaking watching it happen. You know, you see someone climbing up a cliff, and you actually, you know, lean when he leans because it sucks you in to that extent. I like the snowy setting that they showed us, you know, replacing that kind of fog of war with that snowstorm of war. It was a great way of kind of limiting the vision, and it was really neat to see things in such a bright white setting, where the field of vision was still limited. You know, it's going to be a great game. But you're right, no surprises, but plenty of excitement.
The mission they showed us really resembled the all ghillied up mission from the first Modern Warfare, where that's the one where you're setting up to snipe the, I can't remember the character's name, but he's sort of a diplomatic official. You shoot his arm off. And, you know, it sounds strange, but I think that game is at its best when you're not shooting people per se, and it's setting up that action with interludes and sneaking around, and just that sort of mood setting was really successful in the handful of moments that it did do in the first game. So it was promising to see more of that in that sense. All right, well, we do have a handful more games I wish we could address. We're sort of running out of time here. I'd love to get some of you guys' questions in, especially about Left 4 Dead. If you guys have any specific questions about something like Mafia 2 or Monkey Island, Front Mission games, Ruse, Singularity, send them along to us, and we'll definitely attack that next week.
Left 4 Dead 2, awesome or too much too soon? Well, seeing as how we're still waiting on Half-Life Episode 3, it's way too much, way too soon. I think that Valve is just collapsing under fan pressure for melee weapons and different characters and different campaigns. It's too much. Love podcast. Josh Augustine, still hot for you. Sorry, baby. See you guys later.
Hey, PC Gamer. It's Chris from Utica again. Was just listening to you guys talk about your E3 impressions, and I couldn't help but chime in. My reaction to the Left 4 Dead 2 announcement was to further ponder the fate of Half-Life Episode 3. And I know I'm not alone in this. I mean, there was a bit of a cliffhanger at the end of the last installment, if anyone remembers. My hope is that Valve is already developing a new game engine for Half-Life 3. Do you think that waning anticipation might cause Valve to cancel the third episode and discontinue their current story arc in Half-Life 3? On the other hand, Left 4 Dead 2 announcement suggests that Valve still finds the Source engine marketable. If that's the case, then this announcement simply reinforces my notion that it might be a while before we see the likes of Half-Life 3. As always, thanks for the show.
All right, so thanks, guys, for sending your questions about Left 4 Dead 2 this week. Again, that issue is getting out to subscribers, our August issue right now, and it'll be on newsstands right around June 23rd in North America. And we know this is a big topic for you guys. We're not ignoring it at all. This Left 4 Dead 2 boycott that some 25,000 Steam users are backing because they think the game is coming out too soon. They don't think it's distinct enough. So lucky enough, we were lucky enough to catch up with Chet Falzek of Valve, one of the big shots behind Left 4 Dead 1 and 2 at E3. And we asked him some general questions about the game, the new updates of stuff that we saw from our demo at the show. But we also got him to talk a little bit about and justify why it's coming so soon and sort of address excuse me, those concerns that we're seeing out there. So
there are a couple differences that I noticed between the build that we saw about a month ago, I guess,
yeah,
and this one. The UI is a little bit different. I like seeing the sort of suits, the hazmat suits.
Yeah.
Those infected characters were there before. Is that sort of meant as a means of showing the footprint of the government a little bit there?
So the hazmat suits are what we call an uncommon common.
Okay.
Each area is going to have its own version, at least one of them. Like they may have multiple. So the idea would be is they would be having hazmat suit guys there. And so that's cool, right? It's a new common infected, and we have a ton of common infected so that you're not seeing the same dude all the time.
Right.
But they also, the uncommon and common, hence the name uncommon, have also little traits to make them different. In this case, this uncommon actually is fireproof. So the hazmat suit protects them. And there's actually a section where you'll run into quite a few of them, where all of a sudden your incendiary ammo is not going to be so effective, and your, obviously bullets still kill them, but, and your Molotovs aren't effective, right?
Right.
And so it mixes up the gameplay. When you see them, you've got to make some different choices.
And that's maybe part of a larger design of creating a bigger spectrum of enemies. I mean, you have the sort of mutated version of the special infected, the Wandering Witch.
Yeah.
There'll be some more after that as well, so.
Cool. Yeah, so, I mean, Left 4 Dead 2 is made by the guys who made Left 4 Dead 1, and also essentially by people who play Left 4 Dead 1 all the time, right? And so it's kind of turning some of what we did Left 4 Dead 1 on its ear a little bit, or having some fun with it and understanding why that worked, and you know, kind of playing within that and having some fun on that side of it. And also it's, you know, if you've played with me or anyone else on the team, Left 4 Dead, you've helped influence Left 4 Dead 2.
Great.
Because it's really, we're pretty tight with our community, and it's that kind of feedback with them and talking about it that, you know, after the announcement and then people saw some of the new stuff, I got a bunch of emails like, hey, is this my thing? We talked about this. And it's like, well, you know, a lot of those, there's like a whole genesis that's cross-pollinated with a bunch of people talking about things and everything. So I couldn't even tell you who came up with individual things internally, let alone that. But it's just having that kind of relationship with our community, I think, that's helped make Left 4 Dead 2 be like, if you love Left 4 Dead 1, you don't look at Left 4 Dead 2 and go, oh, man, they did this and this and this, and I always wanted to be able to do this. Like, right. Whack things in the head with a pan.
Absolutely. As is your ringtone.
Yes.
It might still be, yes.
It is. I have to change it, though. The cat is terrified of it.
That's excellent. So I know it's probably your number one question today, like why so soon? Are you going to continue to support Left 4 Dead 1 with new content? I mean, have you talked about that yet? Is that a decision you made?
So I think probably the easiest way to talk about it is thinking how Valve works. So yeah. Left 4 Dead 1 gets finished, right? Most of the team gets some time off where I guess we're supposed to report PTO, but we really don't. And kind of wander around, and we get back together, and you can go work on whatever you want. For example, Kim Swift works on Left 4 Dead 2. Right, and anyone on the team could switch around. Some of us who worked, I mean, at that point, people who worked on Left 4 Dead kind of started talking like, well, you know, we always wanted to do this or we wanted to do that. Some of Left 4 Dead, we kind of inherited some things, and we wanted to kind of have this ability to start fresh on some stuff of like, we have this marrying of story and gameplay we did, right? And like, if you make a TF level, that map can stay on its own and kind of has its own internal history or story and consistencies that it has to keep. Well, Left 4 Dead has this bigger, you know, if all of a sudden Bill and Zoe were in Hawaii, like, why? What's going on here? And so, you know, we started talking about some new characters, new locations, and then we all kind of met up and went on a whiteboard, started throwing around a bunch of ideas, and it really was almost kind of surprising of how much there was a common thought running through it and a kind of a singular focus on it. So we're like, okay, this is cool, but this is a lot. Like, we're talking new characters, new models, all new art assets, new music, like Mike Moravsky in from Left 4 Dead 2, the music actually changes with which campaign you're playing through.
Right.
The world changes with which campaign you're playing through. The characters change with which campaign you're playing through, right? There's like all these things we wanted to do and build on Left 4 Dead. And again, it's we play it. We, you know, the minute we hit that button to launch it, we went upstairs and played with other gamers, right?
That's great.
We actually were the first Pub Stompers, which is probably a bad thing to start, but okay. But so, you know, we just kind of had all of that focused, and so the team said, okay, this is something we want to do, and we actually took it to, you know, Gabe and Doug and Scott Lynch and said, hey, you know, this is what we want to do. You know, Gabe's kind of like, well, this is a little different for us. And we're like, we can do this quickly because we can go branch off today and start working on the director, you know, lets us kind of start working on maps and new ideas and new concepts right away. And so we kind of keep splitting the team up where some people are experimenting, some people are actually creating shippable content. You know, is that just going to the team and saying, hey, you know, I'm going to like Gavin something, this is what we want to do, this is what the team wants to do. We love Left 4 Dead, we worked on it. We're close to it, and we think this is what people are going to want.
Sure.
They're not, you know, instead of this, like, tiny little incremental thing, like, for example, I think it's like a director. The director's smarter now because it has more creatures to throw at you. You couldn't make the director smarter without more creatures. But the more creatures say, hey, you're playing this way, I'm going to throw this kind of creature at you versus another.
I see.
Right? And so it was kind of all these integrated, intermixed things that none of them were like, oh, you can do this in 5 minutes. Or, no, you can't do anything in 5 minutes. But, like, survival mode, we knew we could go out and get out there and we could get feedback on that and what that was like, right? And so we kind of focused on the survival mode. We wanted to get those other versus maps out. We wanted to update the matchmaking. In fact, we announced today Left 4 Dead 2, and next week we're going to be talking about the updates that are coming for Left 4 Dead 1.
Oh, really? Great.
Right? So, you know, we're not throwing Left 4 Dead 1 under the bus. We still have a bunch of updates coming out for that. In fact, you know, we're going to have the servers running still and everything like that.
Yeah.
You know, so this is, again, something different for us, but it's different in a way that works for us, and it's driven not by some marketing decision or some profit decision. It's really driven by the team wanting to do this big thing that's a cohesive statement and, you know, having this cohesive unit of the story that comes from Savannah to New Orleans and all the changes that happen inside of there.
Great. Yeah, thanks for that.
How's that for the insanely long-winded answer? Dear God.
That works.
You don't need to ask any other questions. I've answered them all.
That works. I mean, I wish, I mean, for example, like Activision had like, a response of that nature when, you know, they're pumping out Call of Duty titles every single year. But anyway, that's a different topic. So one of the things I'm most curious about that isn't implemented in the build we're seeing today is the dynamic weather system, which is also controlled by it's another tool for the director.
Correct.
Can you give us an idea of what that's going to look like, what effects it's going to include, what it's meant to provide?
So we have we have a bunch of stuff going on already. So like just for anyone listening to this and hearing about the stuff at E3, think of everything we're showing as an example of a bunch more. We kind of wanted to be really focused so we can not have to talk about a million different things at E3. I think the announcement of Left 4 Dead 2 is probably surprising enough. So we wanted to narrow it down and take prime examples of each of these and show them. And so we're actually not even showing this here. But the example we're talking about in the weather effects is thunderstorms that come up. And so if you live in the south, where I live in New Orleans, in the summer, every afternoon at 4 o'clock, something like a thunderstorm rolled out of nowhere, hit, and then went away.
Yeah.
And so one of the cool things we're thinking about is where it's implemented now is actually in a swampy area. But it's like you'll see this field and you'll think it's clear. And it can happen anywhere. The director's controlling it, but we kind of tie it to campaigns. And so the director's controlling it, and all of a sudden we get this clap of thunder. And you know, in 5 seconds, it's going to start raining so hard, I'm not going to be able to see my teammates anymore. I'm going to have, like, you're in the cornfields in Blood Harvest where you can't see outlines, you have all this problem navigating. Creatures can be 5 feet away from you, and you're not going to see them. And so it gets scary. So you're going to, you have those few seconds, and you're going to go run for cover. You're going to go run to find a shack. You're going to go run to find some trees to stand next to something. And so the director's able to control that now. So it can really mess with you. Not only are the infected going to be coming up more in this different specials, but now also events like this happen where you actually have to change where you're going to move to next, and you have to decide how you're going to handle that.
Yeah. I almost get the image in those cartoons where a thundercloud spawns right over somebody and follows them around, right?
Yeah, kind of similar.
It's kind of interesting. Will be as much a hindrance in versus mode to the infected as the survivors?
Since the infected always get to have the outline, like the cornfield, okay. They'll still be able to do that. And so they'll hear the thunder as well. They'll know that this event's coming. One of the things with that is we have painfully talked a lot about in versus mode, about making... there's a part of versus mode we like that there's still some randomness in it, but also there's some serious people in that space who want a really clean competitive thing and maybe make some kind of versus mode for them where the director kind of respects that they want more of an even playing field versus more of a different exciting experience, right? And so we've talked a lot about that, or is there some middle ground that both would be happy to? Talking with some of the leagues now, and if I haven't talked to your league now, I'm probably going to be emailing you soon now that we've announced. And there's some things we want to do there to try to help that, because it's been really interesting to see the competitive side of Left 4 Dead come out in versus mode and in the leagues.
Absolutely. I'm sure it's kind of an interesting challenge because, in one sense, your design is rooted in asymmetry to some extent, and you're sort of going at opposite ends. I don't know.
But, I mean, I do understand that, like, hey, we got a tank right here. But then again, if you know about the tank right there, then it's like it's. Well, one of the interesting things is we are collect stats like crazy,
right?
Obviously, some people can see their stats now and see what we collect. We also collect kind of meta stats. And one of the things we saw when we did the flip, where the losing team gets to play infected first, so they get to learn the map, what's going to happen in the map before the other team. And we found also we had a jump in people completing versus games. So that helped people understand and kind of get a little further in. So, it really is, I can't stress it enough, it's the community that's helping us with Left 4 Dead 2 while we play Left 4 Dead 1 with them, or we watch Left 4 Dead 1, or we collect stats about Left 4 Dead 1.
Great.
I mean, it's this weird, if you read the forums, everybody plays either on expert or they play versus mode. But in reality, they don't. Mm-hmm. Most people play normal. And co-op is played just as much as versus. And some people just play co-op. Some people just play co-op with the same 4 people.
Really?
Right. And so you have these kind of like Friday night games, and now we're going to go play this. And it's this kind of social aspect that Left 4 Dead gives it, where you're having a shared experience. You're all together. It's a small, discrete group. And, those kind of things we look at and we go, well, how can we improve that? How can we help that make that better?
Okay. Yeah, that's certainly one of the most exciting aspects for me. So getting at the melee weapons, which is maybe the most, like, moment-to-moment exciting new improvement, I think. For me, like, I noticed the nuance almost immediately. I don't know if you consider them completed, but, like, with the fire axe, for example, I can sort of strafe across 2 targets and time my swing to get both of them. There's a lot of room there for experienced players to challenge themselves, I think, and that's really the most exciting thing for me. Is that reflects your design, you think?
Yeah, so... I think one of the things when we're looking at that is, like, we're looking at, I think I already used the example of the witch.
Yeah.
So the Wandering Witch and how the axe works really against the Wandering Witch. Well, all the melee weapons have some kind of thing that they're better at than others. And one of the things, I don't want to talk about all of them because it's cool to watch the people, the mythology of Left 4 Dead grow as they're trying to figure out these things. Right? We saw that with Left 4 Dead 1. But definitely each of the melee weapons kind of has something that's really good at. And, you know, you always, when you add something new to a game like Left 4 Dead, you always want to make sure, like, A, it's not, you don't want to make it the thing that everyone all now wants to use, they don't want to use anything else, but equally you want to make it something that they do want to use. And the perfect thing is if they want to use it when they understand how it works and there's situations that arise where it works, or it's just fun to use, right? I think, like, the frying pan cracks me up, so.
Yeah. Absolutely. Great. And finally, I'm really interested in the way you guys are integrating themes. I mean, FEMA as an organization and being in the, you know, where Katrina happened, essentially, within your fiction, and creating, I'm not sure what the name of the organization is.
CETA.
CETA in the game. What does that stand for? I'm sorry.
Oh, you're going to kill me on that one.
It's okay.
You could find out when you go to the Steam store and buy a CETA mug.
That sounds good.
Your number one source for natural and man-made disaster relief. I do remember the tagline.
That's great, because you have the Aperture mug and you have the Black Mesa mug. That's great. So, I mean, was it something you were eager to do, like, tell more of a thematic story rather than a... I mean, I'm not sure how you compare that to Left 4 Dead.
So, definitely in Left 4 Dead 2, we wanted to tell this different story of the world and how the different people react. You'll see as you go across the South that there's people who react radically different from others. And just the kind of, like, the falling apart of society and different things that happen. But with that, be really clear, we're not trying to make a statement about Katrina and FEMA.
Of course.
I actually lived in New Orleans for a little bit. We got to go back down there while we're doing research. If you go back down there now, I think people are going to be surprised of just still how much work is needed down there and how bad it is. It's still a beautiful city, so you should go visit. It's an amazingly great place to vacation. But with utmost respect, we're working on the game and in that space, right? We're not trying to be edgy or tell, like, what was the buzzword last year? Was it just edgy?
Probably.
Or, no, subversive. We're not trying to be subversive about it.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know.
I understand the desire to bring it into a new setting and what the southern setting brings, but what about the desire to bring it into full daylight? And how does that change the focus? It's like there's less scare and there's more focus on just pure action, less jump out of your seat moments.
Sure.
Is that part of the goal, to differentiate it?
Well, so to be clear, we're just showing two maps of one campaign.
Right.
This just happens to be daylight, because we want to show something really different. There's nighttime maps. There's early morning maps. There's maps during storms. There's all kinds of different things happening. But we did want to play around with that, right? And because it does mix it up.
Right.
And so one of the cool things with Left 4 Dead was, you know, when you start talking about zombies and stuff, you can look like the Max Brooks books and everything. There's all this lore there. You can look at the original Dawn of the Dead movies or 28 Days Later. And they all have their own fiction and stuff. We wanted to make sure that we... had our own internal fiction and our own internal consistencies and rules. And so one of the cool things when we're listing up stuff, I know some guys in the art team were talking about, and this Randy Lundin was like, hey, let's see some sun. Let's brighten it up. It's already so dark. And then, you know, some other people instantly chime in, well, hey, that means they're gonna behave differently because at nighttime they behave like this, right? And so then like, well, the witch is going to be more agitated, so she's going to be up and wandering around, and also you're going to have to deal with that. There's actually some other cool stuff that happens in the day that we're not showing here, where the common infected are a little bit more in a different state. And it was just to give that for the gamer of something cool, of, like, what, if you wonder what it was like during the day, you know, here you go, here's some of it.
So it's not just the atmosphere, and it's not just being able to see more of it, the behavior is really will change.
Correct, yeah. And so, you know, when you jump into that, you can say, well, it's not as scary, because I can see further. Well, it's different, but, you know...
There might be more aggression, there might be more challenges that the daylight provides.
Exactly. It's always that kind of thing of, you know, Left 4 Dead gives you some scares, it gives you some sense of dread, I think, at times. But, you know, it's definitely
the tension will be there. You might ratchet up. You might pull back, kind of like the jump out of your seat factor, but ratchet up the tension by having.
Until you have a charger knock you off the bridge, and then you kind of, you know, that'll do it for you. So yeah, the final campaign, in fact, is you going across the Mississippi Bridge, and it's a bridge that the rails have been busted out of. There's craters inside of it. This whole story that happens there, but it's like it's a pretty tough go, and daylight or not, it's tough. And you have the charger that's made to knock people distances, and he can knock you right off that bridge. And that's really fun at versus.
Yeah,
certainly. That's fun enough that you run down to the office and rub it into the guy's face that you just did.
Excellent. Well, thanks for sharing all this with us, Chet. Really appreciate it, and looking forward to seeing Left 4 Dead 2 on November 17th.
November 17th. All right. 360. All right. Thank you guys for having me.
Of course, but not on our calendar.
Thanks again to Val for giving us that quick interview at E3. Hope you guys enjoyed it. And please feel free to keep forwarding us your questions about Left 4 Dead 2. We played more time in it than any other journalist out there. I'm a hardcore Left 4 Dead player myself, so I'm really happy to attack these issues for you guys and continue to talk about them and generate a nice conversation about that. So that about wraps it up for us this week. We have an appointment, so you have to jump off a little quickly here. If you'd like to subscribe to our magazine, head on over to pcgamer.com. All the information's right there. And if you'd like to submit questions for next week's podcast, just email us at pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com and attach an MP3 to that and keep it under 1 minute. Or you can give us a ring at 877-404-1337, extension 724.
And I'll just throw this in real quick. I encourage anyone, I know we didn't get to talk about all the E3 stuff this podcast, but I encourage anyone who loves Monkey Island to listen to this week's OXM podcast. So OXMpodcast.com or just look through it on iTunes. We interviewed Dominic Armato. Or I didn't. Ryan McCaffrey did, who's a big Monkey Island fan, just like all of us. And Dominic Armato had a lot of awesome things to say about the process of remaking The Secret of Monkey Island.
We actually wanted to mention, you guys, I'm not sure if you're aware, we have a dedicated Team Fortress 2 server that we're starting to host some events on every week or so. Max, you have some information about that for us? Direct people to it?
Yep, tonight is Team Fortress 2 with the PCG crew. Starts at 7:30 Pacific time. We'll be playing on our very official server, which is 66.151.138.34:27015. We're trying to try to make this into a semi-regular occurrence, so we encourage all of you to drop in, play a while, and when you're done, leave us a comment in the Jumping All Over the World announcement on the Steam page and tell us what you'd like to play in the future.
All right, fantastic. Thanks very much, Max. Yeah, we're looking forward to getting it on with you guys in Team Fortress 2. And yeah, feel free to hop on our server tonight. Until then, we'll see you next week. I'm Evan Lottie signing off. Take care, guys.
Thanks, Evan. Bye.
Bye-bye.